For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
We're on chapter 3, but I want to go back to the very end, chapter 2, verse 21. There's a little episode, and part of the concept of the Megillah is that things happen for a reason, and sometimes at the time we don't know what the reason for it is, and even before the danger of Haman began, Hashem put a number of things in place that would be there to save us. And the first one we mentioned was, in general, having Esther, the queen, Esther Amalka, in the palace. The second one is that the king would come to trust Mordechai and see that he was looking out for him. And we mentioned to you that Mordechai happened to speak this language of Tarsus, of these two guards, that they was unexpected. They didn't think a Jew would know their language. And there's an interesting idea that when, if for whatever reason, we happen to study something or learn something or meet somebody, there's no such thing as an accident, meaning that everything that Hashem gives us in life is there for a reason. And we just never know when it'll come in handy or when we'll find a use for it, but it's there for a reason. And so Mordechai brushed up on this language in order to be able to hear witnesses that might come from that country. I don't know whether he ever had a witness that came from that country or not, but these two guards were speaking a plot to kill the king, and Mordechai overheard them, and he happened to understand, and they thought, there's no way that Mordechai would, he doesn't look like one of us, he wouldn't know our language, and sure enough, he knew the language. Katzaf Bigstam Viserish, these two people got angry, and these people were two important officers who were part of the king's guard. The Yivakshu Ishayab the Melech, and they were trying to kill the king. Now, most people assume that Esther would have been in danger also. In other words, if the king is in danger, then the queen is in danger, because she's part of the government, so to speak. And other people say that the real question is this: why did Mordechai save the king? Maybe we're better off without the king. You know, here's the chance. You know, here's this. We realize that the government that we have is really the one we deserve, so to speak. Like, things that happen are in Hashem's hand. We're supposed to do our best to get the best kind of leaders that we have, that we can get, when it's up to us, when we can have an election, when we can get the right kind of leaders, we certainly do the best we can. But when it's not up to us, it's in Hashem's hands, and we have to be loyal to our people that are doing the best they can. So, Mordechai didn't, apparently there was a plot to kill the king. It was his job to report it. The Avodah Adavar Mordechai V'yagid, he told Esther. And Esther did an interesting thing. We learned out an interesting rule here, that you always have to credit the person that you get it from. In other words, that if something comes from someone else, you're supposed to give them credit for it. There are many times people will take an idea or advice, or they'll write a paper that they got from someone else, and they don't credit the original source. We consider that very important, to acknowledge where something came from. The Gemara even says that brings redemption, because over here the whole miracle came about. If Esther had taken credit for this, then Mordechai would have never been known to the king, and then the reason he got angry with Haman was that Haman was trying to kill Mordechai, and he knew Mordechai was loyal to the king. How did he know Mordechai was loyal to the king? Because Esther told him. So if she had not told him, that was also a link in the Purim miracle. And so it's important in general, like we say, to give people credit. We try to, the Gemara, if you've ever heard Gemara, is very often, it takes a long time to recite the names, because not only do you hear the name of the rabbi, but you hear the rabbi who we heard it from. And some people get annoyed when you hear a lecture because the rabbi is always quoting somebody. He's always, you know, the Ramban says, or so-and-so heard in the name of... And it's just the idea of trying to give a person credit. You know, somebody has that idea, somebody did that. a person can say, you don't need to mention me, but if you have some good idea or something good originated from somebody, pass that on. So-and-so had this great idea, or it was so-and-so's idea. Like that, it creates goodwill. It's to give people credit, and it's the when you want to create goodwill, and when you want to do the proper thing, why should people think that it was my idea? It was so-and-so's idea. That's a very important concept, and that's over here. That's what Esther did. And again, she did it on her own. Mordechai didn't tell her. She went to the king and she said, "Oh, by the way, there's a guy named Mordechai who was the one who told you about this." So the Ivakish Adavar, and they sought it out. The Amata, and they found. And the Yitu Shnei Amaleit, and they hung these two people on the tree. The Yitu B'Sefer Divrei HaYamim, and it was written down and then forgotten. as things happen. Or for now, it was forgotten. And this happened, and years went by, and this was just an event. But as we know, nothing is an accident, and later on, this will be one of the keys to the eventual saving of the Jewish people. But this idea of giving people credit, or not trying to take someone else's idea as one's own. There have been many great people that have fallen because they've stolen other people's ideas and pretended they were theirs. All they had to do was say where they got it from, but there's something about it that people are reluctant to admit where they got it from someone else, or that it was someone else's idea and they just copied it. And but that's a very important concept. Okay. Chapter 3. After these things. So there's always a question, what are these things? Some people learn that the king really didn't know that it was Mordechai that did it. In other words, it was written in the book that Mordechai did it, but it wasn't necessarily told to him that Mordechai did it. We'll see later on, when they start reading the book, he says, "Mordechai was the one who saved my life? What was done for him?" It's almost like he didn't know it. But when they recorded it, they wanted to make sure they got it right. But when they told it to him, maybe he didn't know. Some people say Haman took credit for it. Haman, and that's why Haman all of a sudden, after these things, all of a sudden Haman is raised up, right? Other people say that Haman was the one that advised him to get rid of Vashti. And he was very happy with Esther because he realized that she was not only beautiful on the outside, she was beautiful on the inside. And so now that after these things refers to after he found his queen and he was happy with her, so he was grateful to Haman that he got rid of the old queen that was no good. And so that's the after these things. The third explanation would be after these things refers to after the Jewish people went to that big party. And it creates an anger. There's the idea that Hashem is not quick to punish. And some people get confused by that. It's almost like the person did something wrong and he was struck by lightning, then, that would take away our free will. Like, if any time somebody did something, they were zapped. But in our minds, that's the way we think. Like, I did it, And if they don't get immediate punishment, we believe that Hashem does not always act quickly, that he's slow to punish. It says that when he started the flood in the times of Noah, that at first it was like rain. And he wanted to see, and then it was like heavy rain. And then he wanted to see if the people would say, maybe someone's angry with us. Maybe we have to behave better. That Hashem works with us. He gives us a hint, and he wants us to do teshuva before he has to punish. And so the Jewish people went to this party, and there was time for them to say, we really shouldn't have gone. And if they had done that, if they had done teshuva, if they expressed regret, if they had felt bad, then maybe this wouldn't have had to happen. But the time went by, they went to the party, and the Jewish people, they had kind of acknowledged that the Beis HaMikdash was not going to be rebuilt. They gave up a certain hope. It's interesting also, having hope is a Jewish concept. We're not supposed to give up hope. We're not supposed to be people that give up or they're depressed or we would have been gone a long time ago. There are other nations, they lose their homeland and they lose their... part of our hope is that Mashiach could come at any time, at any day, or that some of the people, by going to this party, were showing that, we'll never get back to Israel. They had thought that the 70 years was up. There was a big debate. The Jews, when they were told the temple was going to be destroyed, they also were told, but after 70 years, he'll come back. And there was a question of when do you count to 70 years from? Is it from the certain king? Was it from the downfall of Yerushalayim? Was it from the destruction of the temple? There were a whole bunch of different countings. And this big party that they had was 70 years of the beginning of the government of Ahasuerus. He thought that was proof that he wouldn't lose control, that this Jewish prophecy didn't come true. So a lot of Jews after that, they said, you know what? We give up hope. And they went to that party where they were wearing the clothing of the Kohen Gadol, and they were drinking out of the gold and silver things from the temple, and they had just given up hope. And so,
is that the same as at Sinai? They gave up hope on the 40 days?
Of him coming back, of Moshe coming back, something like that. In other words, the people lose, they're supposed to keep the faith. You're supposed to have hope, right? That's right. So it could be that's the... because they had gone and they had given up. Now, if they had regretted it, if they had changed, this wouldn't be necessary. But Hashem decided that he needed to shock the Jewish people. And so now he's going to raise Haman up. And the Gemara says an interesting thing, that historically there have been different times, things that Hashem has done to help us do teshuva when we need to change course or we need to rethink things. And sometimes he would send a message to a prophet. You know, go tell the Jewish people that they need to fix their act and they need to do this and they need to do that. It says that the making Haman the most powerful minister in the country did more to get the Jewish people to do teshuva than any other thing until then, than all the prophets put together. It was an amazing... When the people saw that Haman was wearing the king's ring, that was like... there was a big change. Part of the miracle of Purim, and it comes before Pesach, is it was a new redemption. It was a new... everything changed. The people, they needed that jolt. They needed that fear. And so you might ask, well, what do we celebrate? Well, Haman came against us and he was defeated. No, that's not what we celebrate. We celebrate that we had a new outlook on life. It changed everything. When people realized that there was something wrong and that there was a danger above them, there are many good things that happened because of this. And we'll see. But one of the main things was our biggest problem, and that is that we sometimes have a lack of unity. That we each one does his own thing, and he doesn't care about the other, and or we argue with each other. And when Haman came in the scene, and he said, I'm going to wipe out the Jewish people, there was a big togetherness that brought everybody together. And there hadn't been this togetherness, like, because all of a sudden, all the petty things didn't matter. You know, when your life person's life is threatened, so you're going to worry about, you know, what, like little things. You know, do you say the prayer for Israel? Do you not say the prayer for Israel? Do you dress like this? You don't dress like... what are you arguing? I mean, you know, here this guy's trying to wipe us out. You're going to sit and argue about silly things? You know, you like a long speech, you like a short speech, you want to do this, you want to do that. Our life's in danger. So Haman, this bringing of Haman, or really the Purim miracle, brought about a whole new change in the Jewish people. People stopped being petty, and they got together on one page, and ultimately this almost brought the complete redemption, and it led the way to it. And that's why, time-wise, Purim comes before Pesach, because if we build on like the unity and the joy of Purim that came about through what happened, then we're there. You know, redemption's around the corner, and that's kind of it's going to be the message. But before that, sometimes people need a threat. Sometimes they get a scare, and it changes their life. So our goal is to not need a scare. We can be scared from Haman and realize, you know, we don't need a doctor to tell us that, you know, there's some scary thing out there and therefore we're going to change our life and we're going to be better. We're not going to be petty. We're going to get... So when we have Purim, we're supposed to kind of think that a little bit. When we hear the Megillah, that we don't need ISIS or we don't need some scary person to... I keep thinking that when this ISIS is like chopping people, those could be Jews. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that they were chopping Jews' heads, you know. And look what happened in was it Amsterdam? Was that where it was?
Copenhagen.
There was a Jew who was shot in shul. You know, we have to kind of we have to try to get the benefit of being scared. In other words, the benefit of being scared is we don't worry about petty stuff, and we make life count because we don't know how much life is very precious, how much it is. And all those benefits came from Haman. But so let's see. Achad, after these things, Gido Hamelech Achashverosh es Haman. Achashverosh picks Haman up and he raises him. He makes him the top minister in the land. Now, Haman himself was a bad guy, was wicked, and we're going to see what he was. But it's one thing when a person is bad, he could change his mind. But it was worse than that. He was from a people that hated the Jews. Who was Haman? Ben Hamdasa Agagi. He's descended from Agag, which is very interesting because Agag was the king of the Amalekim who King Saul had spared. He had shown mercy. There's the idea, when you show mercy when you're not supposed to, it could come back to haunt you, you know, like the... So he had shown mercy to the mass killer Agag, and Agag fathered Haman's grandfather. Agag was his grandfather. And they picked him up. The Yosemit Kisim al Kalasarim, and he got the top spot. There were other officers, but he had the top spot. He was the front row amongst all the other officers. Kings in those days, a lot of them, especially these type, they had a lot of parties, but they had somebody else ruling the country. If you look in the Middle East, it's always in the time of like the Turks and they had the Pasha or whatever. The king was busy with the harem and with parties, and he's drugged and, you know, drunk most of the time, and they'd have people that would actually run the country were the ministers. And, you know, Achashverosh, after 180 days of parties and all these women without clothing and all, you get a sense of what he was. He was not a politician who was making peace treaties and leading armies, and he was another party and another party, and you know, he was all about and you could drink as much as you want, and he was so the minister in charge of running the country is a very important position. I mean, he basically takes off his ring and says, here, do what you want, you know, because he was, as long as he could be the role of the king was just somebody who could party and have a good time. And so that's Haman was this person who got the top spot. Verse 2, the Kol Avdei HaMelech Asher B'Shar HaMelech, when you have different ministers, so there's a balance. If one minister is bad, you could have the other ministers intercede. But when one minister is the top one, you can't go around him. And that's what happened over here. The other ministers had to bow to Haman. Korim U'Mishtachavim Haman. They had to bow. Now they point out, this is not just like a courtesy bow. This is like, your face on the floor. This is like this is the kind of bowing you do to a god. This Karim Mishtachavim. If you look in Tanakh, like this is what you do when you worship, you know, like the Muslims, they do, if you've ever seen the picture, you know, this is like the full, this is not the Japanese, you know, like the, you know, this is like Haman was, made himself like a god. I mean, like it's hard to imagine the arrogance of this person here, you know, like but that's what it was. If you have everybody treats you like a god, and they got a, in other words, they bend and then they bow. They got to kiss the floor when you walk by. He came to the Hamelach, and that was the command of the king. And an interesting thing happens. Mordechai lo yikarei. Mordechai doesn't bow. So maybe he doesn't want to put his face on the floor, but he could at least show courtesy. He doesn't move. He doesn't flinch. So this is very interesting. They asked this question, why didn't Mordechai do that? Wasn't that kind of foolish of him to mess with Haman? Like, you know, you're allowed to show courtesy or, you know, whatever. If you're supposed to bow if a king requires you to bow, that's the etiquette. You're allowed to bow. So why didn't he bow?
He's from Binyamin.
He's from Binyamin, that's right.
Who came after they bowed to Esau.
Okay. There are very good.
That's the Hebrew school.
Yeah, very good, very good. There is a tradition that Yaakov Avinu bowed down to Esav, his brother, and he bowed down together with all of his sons who were there at the time, and some people felt he overdid it. And there is something about Jews that sometimes they try too hard to please the Gentiles. They bow down too hard. There's a reason for it. I mean, in other words, that's been a historical fault with Jews, is that sometimes they bend over backwards to please the Gentiles. And so there's a tradition that the one son, Binyamin, had that strength that he knew He knew not to when not to bow. He knew that at certain times it's not appropriate to totally give in to the Gentiles. And Mordechai knew that the Jews that had gone to the party, because they felt, well, he's our king and we have to show loyalty. And so Mordechai was atoning for that idea that he wasn't going to do everything they wanted. That's kind of the idea that you were expressing coming from the king, from King Saul. Some people learned that Haman was, Hamolech was idolaters. I mean, they were, we're just not used to the kind of people they were. These were people that did human sacrifices and people that worshipped idols, and he wore an idol on his, around his neck. The Christians got that from, they all wear the getch, that came from in ancient times, that some people wore idols around their, on their being, so if you bow down to him, you would be bowing to his idol. A Jew's not allowed to bow to an idol. So that's why they say Mordechai didn't bow down to him. There's a Medrash that says a further answer, that there's a Mordechai and Haman were both, it's very interesting, there's a lot of material on this, but Mordechai definitely had a position in the government. You see that. He's at the king's gates. He was somebody important. He became more important later. And Haman was a person of position in the government. There's a tradition that at one time they both commanded troops. They both commanded armies. And there's a... Haman's army had run out of provisions. And the Medrash says that he went to Mordechai to beg for food, and Mordechai said, if I give up food, then I, my own troops won't have enough food. And so Haman sold himself to Mordechai as a, he had, in those times you could do that as a slave. And so technically Mordechai would have been exempt from bowing to Haman because he actually was Haman's master. He was above Haman. But again, Haman would not have announced this to anybody, or the... There are certain things we don't know. It's hard to understand Haman's anger over here. Like, why is Haman so have to get rid of Mordechai? I mean, like, why does that bother him? Mordechai is not actively trying to do anything to him. Yet Haman all of a sudden has this great anger. But I'm just trying to explain why Mordechai didn't bow. There's an interesting work that some people say that if this wouldn't happen today, because everybody would have said it's all Mordechai's fault. They wouldn't realize that that Mordechai was actually helping us atone for what he wasn't supposed to bow. He was showing Jewish pride and he was not bowing down to the idol. But today we would have turned him over and said, oh, he's a fanatic, But nobody did. Everybody realized that wasn't what happened over here. So let's see what happens. So Mordechai doesn't bow, doesn't prostrate, nothing. So other people said to Mordechai, why do you go against the command of the king? It's interesting. We don't hear an answer. Did Mordechai answer them? We don't hear it. Did he say anything? Did he say, there's no use for me saying? Do I explain it? It doesn't tell us what he answered. It just says that people said to him, Mordechai, you should do this. You should keep the king's command. Bow down to Haman. Okay, verse 4. The next verse 4, there's two or three places in when they read the Megillah that the written word is different than the oral word, meaning that this word, if you look here on verse, it's in verse 4 when it says Va'amram, on the side it says Ka'amram, which means that if you look in the Hebrew, the Chaf and the Beis are almost identical, but they're actually two different letters in the alphabet. And there are two different versions of what's the correct way to read it. And we actually read it as Ka'amram. And there's the idea, I don't actually have what the two differences are. Like, there are certain things in the Torah that are written one way and they're read another way. It's like certain words are pronounced a certain way even though they're written differently. But you see that footnote on the right there? When they actually read it, they read it Ka'amram. It means that there's a hidden lesson here. Whenever you see that, and if you really want to, I could research this one or the next one. There are two or three in the Megillah. All throughout Tanakh, if you want to see some more, on page 30, you see two of them on the right, where those little footnotes, those little circles, those are the way we read it rather than the way it's spelled. And again, each one throughout Tanakh, you find these. Often they're really, sometimes we know what the message is and it's really fascinating, and other times we just don't know if there are two different versions.
Nothing to do with Amram.
We don't know. Maybe. Could be. Yeah. It's the only thing is, if you're following the Megillah and you're following it on the left side and you're hearing him, you'll notice that he's reading it according to the way it's fixed on the right. And so that sometimes gets confusing, because you're actually reading the letter, you see a vase, and he says, "Come, Rob." So,
who decided this?
It's part of the text that we have handed down. In other words, if part of the text is this footnote. In other words, this wasn't a recent... we have a list of places where, even though it's spelled a certain way, it's pronounced this way. English has a number of things like that, where there's a letter that's not pronounced, like you'd have in a word where there's a silent letter, and for whatever reason, the letter's there, but we don't pronounce it that way.
Yeah, but there's no deep hidden.
Right, there's no deep hidden message there. So these type of things, there are a few things in Tanakh. Some of the places, like I said, I'm amazed. You know, like you can have fun with them. In other words, but sometimes you can find an easy answer, and sometimes you have to dig a little deeper to see what that answer is. Why does it have a silent letter, or what's the meaning of the letter, But you should just be aware that they have in Hebrew, it's usually called kri uksiv. Kri means from kriya, how you read it. Ksiv means how it's written. And again, usually it's a letter that's not pronounced in the written part. It's like a double letter but each there's some of them that are, it's hard to say a rule for them.
Jolene, you have a different book, right? Does your book give any explanation?
No.
Yours is the same one. You have the same one.
You have
that.
It has a lot of power.
Oh, that has some additional
later
stuff.
I'll look up front. Maybe there's a lot of.
No, this particular one, it might have said something.
Okay.
Does it change the meaning?
Sometimes it does.
Here, it says when they said.
There is a new one. I didn't have a chance to look this one up when but I just, you know, when I saw it here, I just realized that I couldn't, like, I had to point out to you that it does it, but I don't know why, what the difference is. But often you could find some interesting stuff if you have time to. There used to be in shul, someone always used to ask me in Haftorahs whenever they had a letter, I knew that I had to, somebody would not let me get away without looking it up or the. There are certain, in general, if you study text, you'll find there are interesting. Sometimes there are bigger letters and smaller letters. There's also a reason for that. In other words, in the regular Torah itself, occasionally there's a letter that's written a little bigger than usual, and there's a reason for that. Why it would be that way or the. But anything that you'll notice that's different, there it's because there are certain rules or the.
What would you look into find out?
So on the Torah, they have they have a book called the Mikros Gedolos, which is like 100 commentators. So it'll have there's a good chance that somebody will deal with it. On something like this, Esther, so a common one is they have the Mea Meloas. That's a big Sephardic work on Tanakh that has, they have it in English as well. Many times they bring from, in other words, chances are that you may not find it in one commentator. He may not explain it, but if you have a dozen or two dozen, somebody's going to talk about it. And so if you have a book that brings from many different sources, you're likely to find someone that'll explain it.
Okay. When is it? Is Vayehi the word that usually means something bad?
Yes.
Me?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yes.
With that.
Well, that's true. That's a good point. What's going to happen here is the beginning of Haman deciding he's going to wipe out the Jewish people.
So it could connect to whatever the word is that we're not.
That's right. That's right. And it was Elav Yom Yom Velo Shama Aleihem, and it was that Mordechai did not listen to those that said, "Why don't you bow down?" But Gidu Lahaman, and somebody told Haman, "Lira Siyam the Divrei Mordechai." So it's interesting. The people themselves, they didn't take sides. They wanted to see who was going to win this one. It says they wanted to see if Mordechai would be right or Haman would be right. It doesn't say that they were angry at him. They wanted to, Mordechai said certain words that why he felt he didn't have to bow down. So they told Haman to see who would win this one. It was a power struggle, right? They said, that's what it says. They give Haman liras on Yam the Divrei Mordechai ki higi lehem, because Mordechai told them Asher hu Yehudi, that he was a Jew. He was from Yehuda, not from Yehuda, that he was Yehuda also means strong-willed, like he's like a lion-hearted. Yehuda was the leader of the tribes. In other words, that he was going to stand up for what he believes in. That's what Yehudi means, the Jew. So this would explain that Mordechai told them, you know, I can't bow down because I'm a Jew. I don't bow down to idols. I'm not going to bow down to Haman with his, you know, has an idol around him. I can't do that. V'yar Haman and Haman saw ki'in Mordechai korei mishtachavilo. Haman saw that Mordechai wasn't bowing and wasn't prostrating. V'yemole Haman chema. And Haman was filled with wrath. And again, some people say, by the way, Haman, we take him for like one of the evil characters in life. And here, this person, Haman, we know, was one of the most wealthy people around. We see that he offers the king a huge amount of money. Like the average person wouldn't have had that amount of money. He was a wealthy person, and he had the highest office around, and he had a large family. He had 10 sons who were very influential. Like, he had everything that people would normally associate with a happy person, with a satisfied person. And so you would think that Haman would walk around as happy as could be. He has everything. He has position, he has family, he has wealth. And you know what? He's not happy. You know why? Because there's one person who doesn't bow down to him. Isn't that ridiculous? You know, there's just every single person, they're kissing the floor when he walks in, and there's one person out of the whole group. One person, and he's beside himself. But the unfortunate thing is, we know people like that. There can be one person rubs them the wrong way, and their whole day is gone. Everything, nothing is good. This one thing didn't happen the way they liked it, and, you know, look, sometimes I see this. I'm at a lot of like events because, you know, we do kosher supervision at like weddings, and so they'll have there's a thousand details. There's the wine and the flowers and the band and the chair covers and the food and the, so something will be wrong. I mean, there's going to be one detail. Maybe it was communicated wrong. Maybe somebody forgot. They play the wrong music when they walked in, or the chair covers colors. I meant this kind of pink, not that kind of pink, or they served the wrong hors d'oeuvres or whatever. They were warm instead of hot. Whatever it is, there's certain people that will just be beside themselves. They'll be filled with wrath. You dummy! I told you so many times not to do that. And here their child's getting married. This is the best moment of their lives. They should be so happy and so joyful. And everybody, all their friends are here. And what is it? They're just like filled. That's Haman. That's the power. That's the Haman is like somebody that can. They're filled with wrath over one silly thing. Like, what does this matter? But that's a Moloch. That's Haman. When we read about somebody like that, we have to realize that that's not a negative thing. We're not going to let, like, you know, a little detail, somebody, you know, you have to see the big picture, not get involved, you know, the Haman. One person doesn't bow down to him and he's beside himself. It's just, it's so ridiculous, but it's just unfortunate because we all know there are people like that. It's some little thing, somebody won't say good Shabbos to them, and that's it. That's it. They go bonkers. Or they, like I said, the color of the chair covers is wrong. The band played the wrong song first, or when it could be a small thing, you know, they was a different kind. They didn't have enough this at the table or whatever. And I'm sure everybody wants it to be perfect or the way they want it, but life is not perfect. It really isn't. You know, it's not going to be as perfect as they want it. It's not always the way we envision things. And if somebody lets that fill them with wrath because one person doesn't bow down, he would have been fine. If he just, you know, if one person didn't bow down and everybody else did, would it be okay? No, he was filled with wrath.
Was there a feud that has been going on between the two? You mentioned
right. So some people feel there was a jealousy, or that he knew that that Mordechai was right, or that Mordechai was really greater than him. There was a certain, you know, jealousy, or he had to get rid of him.
Between the two of them, and this may have been the straw that broke the camel's back.
It could be. It could be. Yeah.
I can't see that Mordechai would be competitive with him. I think he just had low self-esteem. No, seriously, because that would bother somebody with low self-esteem.
That one person didn't say, and I've seen people, you know, as a rabbi, like if the rabbi forgot to say, you know, they didn't say Geshavus loud enough, so they think that he didn't say it to them, and so then they're not going to go to that shul ever again, and they're not going to, you know, I mean, like, just a little thing like he didn't acknowledge them, or he knew that it was important to me, and he didn't do, you know, like, there are certain people that get upset over a little thing, and, what?
Trivial,
or that, it's not trivial, it's so important, it's this and that, and it could be anything. It could be they didn't get something in the mail, or it came a week late, or it came 2 weeks late, or it wasn't, whatever, it's like the, but I think the lesson for us is that's Haman. If somebody can't allow a small detail to ruin their lives, or to upset their equilibrium, that's to us, if that's what Haman represents, that's what happens over here. Like one, the whole world's bowing down to him. He's got all the wealth in the world. He's got family. He's got position. The king honors him. But one guy doesn't bow down, and you can't, you know, you're filled with wrath. That's strong, you know. That's a lot of wrath. Now, verse 6, and he was so angry that he also was so arrogant. V'yibez v'ein v'shas yabem Mordechai avado. He wasn't just going to take revenge on only one person like that. In Yiddish they would say it doesn't pass. Like it's like too petty for him to only kill one person. I can't just take revenge on one person. That's like too little. I got to take revenge on the whole people. Because he found out who Mordechai was. He was a Jew and everything. And he decides he's going. That's it. He's going to wipe out all the Jews. He's going to destroy them. And he's going to get all the Jews that were in all the kingdom of Achashverosh. Achashverosh was the king of many 127 different kingdoms. He was going to wipe out the Jews, not just local Jews. Jews everywhere. B'chodesh Harishon u'chodesh Nisan, and this took place in the month of Nisan. B'shnas Shnayim Esrei. This was in the 12th year of Achashverosh. And then Hippopur, he makes a lottery. He throws, and what's very interesting is the name Purim comes from this. We're on page 28, the third line from the top. And they all ask about this. It's very funny that the name of Purim comes from this, because other holidays, the name of the holiday seems to be the essence of the holiday. Whether it's the Pesach, it's the saving of the Jewish lives, Hashem passed over, or Sukkot, where we're in Hashem's special dwelling. What is the fact that Haman threw a lottery? Why is that the key to the holiday of Purim?
Because it's a chance, but there are no chances. God knows.
Right. That's right. So that's what they. Haman felt that things happen randomly, like, you know, the things are random, that you just throw the dice, and that's the, and he thought that the lesson of Purim is that there is no such thing as random, that everything that Hashem does is what we call with hashgacha, with a meaning or with a plan. And so Haman, the idea of Purim is that we see that we think it's just the luck of the dice, you know, just the, he happened to throw the dice, thinking that one of when Amalek tried to defeat the Jewish people, they were denying that Hashem was behind this. They were saying that, oh, it's just good luck. They just had good luck. There was some kind of plague in Egypt, and they escaped, and we can defeat their armies. This was just random. In other words, they refused to see the hand of Hashem in it. And so the way it's seen is that throughout life we have the choice to see things as coming from Hashem, or see them as random, or see them as just the way things happen. And so Haman always is, you know, he poor. It's just the luck of the dice. It's the throwing of the lot. And we see them, no, it's the hand of Hashem. So he throws the dice. And it was, and they fell out. Now, for us, if it had fallen out earlier, the Jewish people might have been wiped out. It took a while for the events to happen. And it was because that it was 12 months in the future, there was time to prevent Haman from destroying the Jewish people and to mount a defense. Other people say that Haman was happy because the month of Adar didn't seem to be a good month for the Jews, like, because Moshe died, Moshe Rabbeinu passes away in the month of Adar. So he thought that this was a lucky month for him, because if the leader, the greatest Jew, died, that meant this was the month where you could defeat the Jews. We have an interesting concept, and that is that we don't believe that death is an end-all, and we don't believe that when people pass away that that's it. We believe that there's an eternity, and that when people pass away, if they were good people, that in certain ways their memory, their good deeds grow, and they continue on. And so we believe that even though Moshe Rabbeinu died in that month, that it's, that doesn't make it an unlucky month. That means that it's a month where Moshe Rabbeinu was also born in that month, which is also true. And again, it's coming up next week. It's going to be the 7th of Adar, and it's a quasi holiday. It's there are people that it's kind of celebrated. It has its own practice. Being there's not too much that we do on the 7th of Adar, but it is the yahrzeit of Moshe. So that's when the month that Moshe died. That's when he thought he'd be able to exterminate the Jews. Verse 8. Now he's going to go figure out how to do this. V'yomer Haman leMelech. So Haman speaks to the king. Now it's interesting here. Sometimes it says Achashverosh, and sometimes it says King Achashverosh. Why do you think it says here King Achashverosh? Haman wanted to present this to the king as something good for the country. So he talks to him as the king. He doesn't say, well, I got this one guy that doesn't bow down to me and I got to take revenge. No, he was much smarter than that. He presents it to the king. We got this people that we want it to be good for the country to get rid of them. That's the way he's going to present it. So he wants to talk to the king. And he presents an argument over here. Very interesting. Yeshnu Am Echad. He says there's this people. Mufuzu Mufurid. Now he accuses the Jews of being separate, of not being unified, and so he says you'll be able to defeat them because they're not unified. Each place is separate, and so the way we defeat Haman is by being unified. And again, when you think about it, all of the mitzvahs of Purim have to do with unity. That's where we, first of all, it begins with a half shekel. The person is half, and together with the community, they're whole. And then it's giving gifts to the poor and having meals together. Everything on Purim is designed to like bring a closeness, like a being connected to people. They're all the mitzvahs of the day. So Haman accuses him of being, the Jewish people, they're mefuzer and mefur, they're like spread out and scattered. You don't got to worry about them. And b'kol medinos malchusecha, and they're all over the place. Like they're everywhere. You need to get rid of them. V'deseim shonus mikol am. It's very interesting. He accuses them, he says their religion, in Hebrew today, that's the same word, dust is religion. He said the way they think is different than others. Their religion is different, the Jews different. And here he accuses them of not being loyal, like not following the king's rules. He says, they don't follow your laws. Well, a melech, you know what? It doesn't pay for you to leave them. It's like, well, just butcher men, women, it doesn't pay for you not to wipe them out. He like, you know, puts it, you know, the, but we're going to see this king, that's pretty drunk most of the time. It was very easy to get him to do things. Some people say that Achashverosh was as big of an anti-Semite as Haman. And he was happy as could be to get rid of the people. What's interesting also is he doesn't mention them by name. He speaks in code. So we, if you look and study history, Hitler, Yimach Shemo, did everything in code. He spoke of a final solution. He didn't say I was going to wipe out the Jews. He said there's going to be a solution, a final one, you know, or let's send the people to the, you know, send them to the west or to the east. And he basically, the Nazis spoke in code words. And today, some of the people that deny the Holocaust point to that because where are the orders? Where does it say to destroy it? But if you look at, they have, the British had all the communications to the Nazis. That's one of the successes, how they defeated the Nazis was that they had the codes. They figured out the secret passwords and stuff of the German high command. And so they actually have in the British, the records transmitted from the death of the Germans saying we're killing Jews, we're wiping out this many, and the Germans kept records. And so as they butchered people,
how detailed they were in record keeping.
Yeah, it's incredible. Sounding. Like even to the number, like they would say, you know, like it was they didn't even round it off. It was like but this idea of speaking in code it comes out over here in Haman's wording. The interesting thing is that somebody wrote 1,800 years ago that Germany comes from a Moloch. It's just an interesting thing. The German Jews certainly didn't think so until Hitler came along. They were descended from Amalek.
Oh, okay.
In other words, that Haman and his descendants settled in Germany. So if somebody wrote that now, they'd say, okay, they act like Amalek. You know, they act like a... But it was written 1,800 years ago. You know, that the Germans came from Amalek. But this idea that they wrote in code that if you want to harm people, that instead of, like, doing it publicly and in the open, that they spoke in code words, you see that right here in the Megillah. Well, there's this people, and it's not good to leave them. He doesn't say, let's massacre the men, women, and children. He says, well, and then he says, Imal Amalek Tov, and he said, you know... He said, I'm not going to take credit for this idea if the king thinks it's good. You know, he really was knew how to speak. So then Kosim loved them. He says, you know what? You should write to let's get rid of them. And by the way, I'll give you $10 million. That says love and kicker kesset. Let's see if that helps at all. You know, politicians always like money. Eshka edeo semalacha, and we'll pay the workers. And you know what? We'll bring this money to the Ginzei HaMelech. It'll enrich the king. This will bring so much wealth to the king. So what does the king do? He takes off his ring and he gives it to Haman. And again, it repeats in case we forgot who Haman was. Ben Hamdasa Agagi. This is Haman. Soror HaYehudim. He was the person who caused. He calls him the enemy of the Jews. And so. It comes out, this really wasn't just about Mordechai not bowing down. Haman had this agenda to wipe out the Jews. This was, he has the king's ring, which means it was like carte blanche. He had a blank check. Here, take the ring, whatever you want. Verse 11, Yomra Melech Lahaman, Hakesa Nasaluch, and the king says, I don't need the money, whatever, Ba'am Lasus Bokato Beinecha. It's interesting why the king refuses the money, like it's, you can keep the money. It almost seems to be like the king says, you'll be doing me a favor. You don't have to pay me for this. I'm happy to let you wipe out the Jews. When you think about it, it's pretty bad. If the king says, I'm happy for you to wipe out the Jews, you don't have to pay me for it. It means that the king and Haman, there are opinions in the Gemara that the king was just as wicked as Haman. Achashverosh. It's just they couldn't write it in the Megillah, but he was pretty bad too.
At this point, does the king know that it's Jews that Haman is referring to? Because he says there's a certain people. He doesn't name them as Jews.
So that's a good point. When later on, when Esther tells the king, you know, somebody's trying to destroy me and my people, Achashverosh says, who is that? Who are you referring to? So some people say he was so drunk he really had no idea what was going on. Other people, he knew, but he was claiming ignorance. It is interesting you point out, it doesn't say the Jews. It just says, oh, Haman said we got this people, and the king says, okay, get rid of them, you know. Doesn't matter who they are. Just, you know, you're the minister, here's my ring, solve the problem.
But I had always thought that the king didn't know.
Oh, so the Gemara makes, there's no question about it, he knew, and he was equally anti-Semitic. He equally wanted to wipe them out. But later on, he was going to claim ignorance. So for Amalek, so they called the scribes in the first month, on verse 12, they wrote whatever Haman wrote, Elah Sharpenei HaMelech. Now this is an interesting word. We're not sure. He calls it like the satraps, but there's some words here that are not so clear. They're like king's officers and king's. There were different people in charge of spreading messages or writing the king's edicts. You know, I think they blew a bugle and then they scroll roll down. You know, hear ye, kind of thing. These are the types of things they were. And the dynamics of communicating in those days and making sure that it would be translated and sent to all the countries, Amam Kesham Hashem HaMelech, and it was written in the king's name, Niktav, it was written, V'nechtam and sealed the Tabas HaMelech. Verse 13, V'nishak Sforim, and they wrote laws, it almost sounds like Obamacare, they had books written on the subject, V'nishak Sforim, they wrote whole treaties on how to do this and how to accomplish this and what should be done with the money and what about the women or what about the children. They wrote a book and they sent it with the runners, Kol Bnei Yisrael Hashmid, to destroy, Laharog, to butcher, Lahaved, Eskola, Yehudim, every single Jew, Menar, Vedzak, and young and old, Taf, little kids, Menashim, Beyond, and do it all in one day, Beshosh, Chodesh, Shnei, Master, Chodesh, Adar, and Shalom, Lavos. And some people didn't hate the Jews, but they were very happy to take their property. I mean, when you offer people that you say that you can do with them as you wish, and they, you could take their property, that would be an incentive for people. Why should people do this? Well, if you kill them, you can take all their wealth. And, unfortunately, throughout history, that's been a, people have wanted to that's been an enticement, is that they, in the Middle Ages, that when the, often if they owed Jews money, they would kill them, because this way they wouldn't have to pay them back. That was the reason that they would, the Crusaders or kings would often kill their Jews, because then they wouldn't have to pay them back. All right, we'll stop here, verse 14.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it, so that he can continue that site.